the infirmary. Does the vibe of the bill take away or increase sourcing control for NDIS participants? I'll ask you first, Darren.
We need more protections in the bill.
I agree that there's a need for more protections, ways to ensure that choice and control can't be overridden using some of the powers in this bill. I don't think that the bill automatically takes away choice and control, but I do think that the bill should reinforce that choice and control is to be protected and defended from any sort of incursions that are not appropriate. And I think that there's a need to make sure that those kinds of protections are put in.
Hi, and welcome to Reform Necessary, Australia's premier podcast series on the National Disability Insurance Scheme, brought to you by the Summer Foundation. I'm coming to you from the Wurundjeri land, and pay my respects to the traditional owners and elders, past, present, and emerging. But before we go any further, please do me a favour and hit the like button, subscribe to the channel, and select the notification bell, so you can be notified of future episodes. In this episode, we're unpacking the proposed changes to the NDIS Act and bringing together Australia's best disability law experts to find out why these changes are being introduced, what they might mean for NDIS participants, and how you can have your say. Check it out. Hi guys, welcome to the show.
Hi George.
Hey George.
It's great to have you. How about we start with some introductions? Can I start with you, Darren?
I'm Dr. Darren O'Donovan, and I teach here at La Trobe Law School, and I teach administrative law, which is the law of bureaucracy.
Yeah, hi, I'm Mitchell Skipsey. You can call me Mitch because we're friends. I'm a senior solicitor at PIAC, the Public Interest Advocacy Centre. And so my work there mostly involves disability rights, including discrimination law, but also, for the purposes of today's conversation, the NDIS.
Let's start with a really important question that's on everyone's mind. Why is the NDIS Act changing?
I think the best place to start with that is looking at when the last election happened and Labor came in. One of the things they said they wanted to do was really look at the NDIS and work out how they can make it work better, make sure that it's sustainable, that it's working for people. And so through a lot of last year, particularly, there was the NDIS review ongoing, and the review's report came out towards the end of last year. So now this act is part of the first real tranche of changes that we can expect to see that give effect to the things that the review had discussed, and really give shape to what the NDIS will look like as a result of that.
Darren, thoughts?
Yeah, I think for me, it's really important that we see this as a process. So the bill has come out, and like we've done before, whenever there are changes proposed, we work through those, we look for information. And I think today it's all about just describing what's in the bill and putting a little information into people's hands. I think today is just helping people feel like they understand, raise some questions, and talk about how we move forward to make this process the best process it can be in terms of examining this bill.
Right. So let's get into it. Now, the draft legislation refers a lot to matters of rules and delegated legislation. These are really complicated concepts. How do they work, and will they provide for good oversight and co-design?
So, there, you know, a lot of us in the scheme have become familiar with things like the NDIS rules. And this bill continues that trend where the main act takes the approach of saying repeatedly, there will be a rule for that later. The details will arrive later by legislative instrument. So for instance, really important decisions in this bill that will be taken in the future, they will arrive by the federal minister tabling a legislative instrument. Now, that process, first of all, means the minister is accountable to the Senate where the document is tabled. So the minister is, it is possible that a minister can say, here's the legislative instrument, and the Senate will say, we disallow that. Okay, so you can have a vote to disallow the legislative instrument. So that's really important and welcome for democratic accountability, because it's not a minister's decision, it's a legislative instrument that the parliament has something of a role in. Now, when we ask about co-design, this is why we wanted to start here, because I feel that we have a good opportunity right at the start of this process to really focus on co-design. Because in this bill, there are moments like the minister will table a legislative instrument defining the assessment tools, which are so important to people with disability. Now, what does the minister have to do before he creates that instrument? The Legislation Act says he should consult. It doesn't attach a lot of consequences to a failure to consult. That's section 19. And for me, when I saw this continual reference to legislative instruments, and the fact that those instruments are going to determine really sensitive and important questions, my first thought was, everyone involved in this process is committed to co-design whenever they speak about this process. We have to legislate co-design into the making of those legislative instruments. It's not enough to kind of say, we will consult. And I'm not saying that people aren't intending on consulting or aren't doing that now. But for me, the question I want people to dive in on is, these are really important rules. The government itself says the assessment tools would be highly technical. What information, views, and evidence should we say have to be tabled alongside the instrument? What do you want to know, George, if a minister shows up with an assessment tool? What do you want to know about the work he's done, the evidence it's based on, the assumptions it makes? We have a moment now to legislate a standard of transparency and accountability. To be honest, the normal rules, which is what's currently in the bill, it's not adapted for people with disability to be heard. It's too fast a timetable. It's a process that's used for things like customs regulations. We really need to design and commit to co-design and put some legislative words behind the really laudable things that everyone is saying across politics on how they want the best quality parliamentary process for anything we do in this scheme.
That's right. I support that. And 5 minutes into the podcast, and we've already come up with one amendment to the legislation. So let's make a tally, hey? I'd like to go to the issue of reasonable and necessary. We know how important that concept is in deciding the funding that the person is allocated. I understand that this is going to be changing as a result of this bill. Mitchell, can you help us understand how reasonable and necessary will be changing?
Yeah, so at the moment there's a series of provisions in the bill that say in order for something to be reasonable and necessary and funded for a participant, you have to meet these different criteria. And people might be familiar with some of those. That's things like value for money or effective and beneficial things. Those are currently various sort of legal hoops that need to be jumped through, but they don't necessarily say what specific types of things might meet those criteria. The new bill establishes or will establish quite a different system for thinking about the funding that somebody might get as reasonable and necessary funding for reasonable and necessary supports. So it first sets up a different system for considering how much and what type of funding a person should get in their plan, and a different structure for structuring plan funding. I might start by talking about the system for determining an individual person's funding. And so first of all, what would happen is that somebody who's become a participant would get a needs assessment. Darren's already name-checked that as being something that the minister would determine what a needs assessment looks like. There'll be a legislative instrument that says a needs assessment involves this sort of consideration, these kinds of assessment tools used to determine what is it that a person needs. Once that needs assessment is completed, then that needs assessment result goes to the agency, and the agency or the CEO and the CEO's delegate would then use a method. That method is also to be determined by an instrument to basically turn that needs assessment into a dollar figure or a set of figures, saying here is the flexible funding that you get to spend on most of the supports you need. And then also any specific stated supports that that are set up there. It's quite a different process that revolves around using a more holistic technical kind of set of assessments, rather than going through on a support by support basis to work out how somebody might need to be funded.
I'm going to ask you, Darren, with respect to this approach, what consideration does the legislation say the minister must have in regard to establishing this instrument and calculating a total funding amount?
So he has to, or she has to, have regard to certain objects. But as a lawyer, a duty to have regard is a very minimal requirement. Okay, so I tell my students it's just basically evident and intelligible engagement with a list of things, right? So, you know, it's really important, I think, that people with disability understand that the primary engines of what's reasonable and necessary under this bill are two things. They are what we are told, and I'm really want to underline this language, will be a world-leading, expert, grounded process co-designed with people with disability to capture their support needs based on what they can and can't do at the daily living level. Okay, what do you need to do all the fantastic things that NDIS participants do? That's the drive of the needs assessment in the NDIS review. That's part one, right? And the part two that we also need to discuss is the working out method. So the CEO takes your needs assessment and uses a working out method created by the minister. And that can be a formula, it can be levels. I mean, I don't want to speculate because the NDIS review itself says we're going to talk about this, okay? Now we can say we need to talk about it now, and that might be something the community, people with disability, want to start doing. But that's a really important thing for everyone in the scheme to understand. And for me, right, George, why are we making that change? Now, one of the things that sort of I always remember in early days setting out on the scheme was being in South Australia and, as an academic, giving a presentation on what reasonable and necessary meant. And in the front row were mums. And they'd come to find out about this, you know, formula, you know, I mean, it's reasonable and necessary, you know. And, you know, across the decade, I think Mitchell will say this as well, I know, I mean, every lawyer, that we have seen people struggle with, what can I get? What are the words I need to find to talk about my life? Are you going to support me to get my needs met? And it's a special form of trauma, really, that people have been through in the decade, where parents have felt this pressure to find the words that might unlock things?
For mine, I think it's right to be asking questions about what could this lead to that I would be uncomfortable with. And I suppose it's really fair for people to say, well, I don't want to have a system that leads to a kind of rationing or caps on things. And so how do we then make sure that whatever system is set up with this bill, which provides a lot of building blocks, how do we make sure that then the shading in of the details makes sure it doesn't lead to those kinds of consequences? Now, there would be versions of needs assessment that this bill could set up that would look really bad. There would be versions of it that would look like all the things that the disability community has rejected in the past. It could look like having to speak to someone that you feel wasn't qualified to assess your needs properly, who used a tool that was inappropriate, who passed on information to government that used a formula that didn't capture the right things. That the bill doesn't rule that out from happening. But the bill doesn't say that's what's going to happen either. And the bill leaves a lot of room for building a system that actually involved a more sensitive and nuanced and appropriately straightforward to engage with kind of system. So I think there are, it's really something for the community to consider. Well, how do we ask the right, how do we ask those questions? How do we make clear our priorities out of those things that remain to be shaded in? And how do we make sure that our voices are able to be heard through the process that's happening now, with the bill being before Parliament, and with whatever processes come next?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. This could end up being quite bad if it's not co-designed and developed properly, but yeah, it could end up working if it's well informed and if people are meaningfully involved in what's put forward. I'd like to now move on to look at the issue of choice and control. Does this bill change the amount of choice and control that participants will have over our supports?
So we know from that great Every Australian Counts report that came out last week that choice and control is such an important element for people with disability, that maintaining that choice and control over the supports they choose, the providers they choose, has been announced clearly into the public domain as a key issue for them. When I look at the draft of the bill, I would be a little concerned that key things that free up choice and control, so flexibility, has been a theme of the reform. And when we look at things like the definition of NDIS support, it's really important for it to be clear. Not clear to me as an expert who can spend, as I have, maybe a week looking at section 10A and the definition of the NDIS support, but clear to everyone. And the new definition of NDIS support that's in section 10 uses an awful lot of words. Now, I know that's a very down-to-earth way of putting it, but it has been, for me, a stressful experience of doing what I do in my everyday life, which is look at the words in context, identify their meaning. There's an awful lot of concepts in there. Some of them come from the United Nations Convention on the Rights of People with Disability, which is a really interesting step, but arguably not all the great concepts that are in the convention have made it to the definition of NDIS support. So I find myself, literally, that is the one that I would love to see the department stop and work through word by word for participants, naming their understanding of what is covered. Because I know from my limited sort of viewpoint that since the bill came out, that section has been flying about the place. I've been trying to look at it with a technical eye, and I guess the feedback I give is, it's taking me too long. And that's the best feedback. So we need to be so sure.
In very easy English, what does a bill say an MBIS support is?
I can have a crack at that. There are probably two key parts to defining what an NDIS support is. And so the first part is what would be the new Section 10A that says an NDIS support is one of a certain number of categories. And it lists those off and it says things that fit in those types of support, something that does one of these things is an NDIS support. If it's not part of one of those categories, it's not an NDIS support. Now, as Darren said, some of those categories, or all of those categories, draw on language from the CRPD, but they don't reflect everything in the CRPD. I guess I would say, as Darren said, it makes it very difficult to understand how big those categories or small those categories are and where the limits are and whether you should be looking at international instruments to understand this piece of Australian law or not. But the first part is that list of categories of things. The second part is Section 10B and C say that there will be rules made, and so rules negotiated between the federal government and the state and territory governments, rules made that say what's in and what's out. So there will be rules that say these things are NDIS supports and these things are not NDIS supports, and that will further define and narrow the scope of what an NDIS support is so that it's meant to be quite clear. Now, at this point, I would reinforce Darren's view that when I read those, I think this is hard for me to understand. And after a lot of hours of straining my eyes looking at it, I'm still not totally clear. And that probably means that there are at least some technical tweaks that could be made to make that clearer. Certainly, as I sit down at some point with my colleagues at PIAC to write a submission, I'm sure there will be things we suggest could be tinkered with there to make the drafting a bit more clear. Underpinning all of that as well is a bigger philosophical question of, even if the drafting is good and clear, is it doing what we think it needs to do? And there might be things that, once we understand what government is meaning to rule in and out, nonetheless, the community might say, well, we think it's not big enough. We think more things should be ruled in for the NDIS, or more things should be perhaps even explicitly left out so that the states should be taking responsibility for them. It's not those bigger philosophical questions are also something to be bearing in mind looking at Section 10.
Based on your experience, both of you, particularly around NDIS appeals, what do you think might be on the horizon in terms of things that might be ruled out? Because you've seen what the NDIS lawyers are saying, we don't want to fund that. Well, you might not want to fund it, but under the current regulations, you have to fund it. What do you think people are most likely to be able to access as a result of these changes? And don't give me a lawyer's response.
Well, like, when I was opening up the bill, what did I expect to see, right? I expected to see the core element of an NDIS support being the support is related to the person's impairment, how they go about, overcoming any barriers they have to functioning in their everyday life. So we know the core idea that should shape an NDIS support is something that addresses the key focus of the NDIS, which is people with disability are supported into inclusion, into participation. And I guess I did expect something a little more direct on what would be out, because I was expecting some of the language we've seen in AAT appeals around ordinary everyday living expense. As a key sort of line that's in the existing rules. And like, what surprised me about Section 10 overall was how different the language was from NDIS language. Like, I had people email me straight away saying, why are they talking about health service, sickness benefits? Like, just at the level of, these people weren't lawyers, but they were just at, I'm finding this really confusing. And then I was trying to read the thing and figure it out in my technical level, while also explaining to them that this is from the CRPD, habilitation means something under the CRPD. So what I would say, George, is I was surprised at the way the section was framed and drafted, and I couldn't really discover how far they want to go and how they want to draw the line. So I have given you a lawyer's answer, you know, and for me, one case I always think about is a fantastic one that I personally have always tried to stick up a bit for. And like, why is flexibility important to people with disability? Because it's creativity, right? We've had that, like when I talk to people in regional Australia, you know, they talk, I mean, the classic Aldi shower chair example of something really small and simple that can unlock great outcomes. The ability to find really great things and put it to a support purpose. And that energy is important to keep, I think. And one case that I always think about is a person with MS for whom an air conditioning unit was the absolute gateway to going about their day, because stable temperature environment, it was up in Queensland, was so important to them. Now, if a tabloid was maybe covering that with a lack of sensitivity for people with disability, they would say, white good air conditioner on the NDIS. But when you're on the ground, as you know, George, when you're on the ground, you realize where supports are found and what can be leveraged for people with disability to drive great outcomes. So the fear is that lawyers looking to draw lines draw the line the wrong side. And we're here today really to say people with disability should be asking, are my supports, are the things I use for NDIS purposes, are they covered by these words? Do politicians know the types of things I am buying and why they might have a relationship with my disability? And to express those in submissions. Because a lot of this is not about some technical drafting exercise. It's about making visible how participants are putting together solutions for themselves.
George, I think I totally agree with the sort of the view that Darren's given there about it's really hard to know what's in and out, and even to the extent, as you say, that some of the things that are listed there in the explanatory memorandum, well, the memorandum might say we don't want to be funding X, Y, and Z, and maybe you philosophically think actually that's wrong for the memorandum to take that position. But when you look at the legislation, the drafting of the legislation doesn't actually make it clear it's doing what the memorandum says it's going to do. So when I look at the section 10 here, one of my early thoughts was there's not a lot in there about social and community participation. So there's less of that, and that could be because the government has earlier said, well, we want states to do a lot more in the way of bringing in foundational supports that might fill a lot of that space. But then, and so if that's what government means to do, to say they're not going to fund as much of that sort of support in NDIS plans and we want to leave it to the states, well, okay, there's a conversation to be had about that. But then when you look at the specific wording of Section 10, my next thought was, well, maybe you could find social and community participation getting funded under habilitation or under one of these other headings. So I would like to, there are a couple of things that the community might say on this. One thing might be to say, government, can you please come out and explain a bit more to us about this? Another thing that you might say is, well, maybe here are some things that we think need to be tweaked in the bill. And again, that's a job for lawyers, for us to still kind of work out how best to put pen to paper as to what those changes might be. And that maybe enables some of that deeper, more philosophical discussion about what are the right categories of things to be supported from here or from there.
What I find interesting, though, about like Section 10 is I think a lot of it may be shaped, as Mitchell says, by a desire to step around things rather than focus on the participant in the scheme. So the bill is trying to manage the relationship with the states, which we know is a source of tension. It's trying to make space for foundational supports and do this task of giving people flexibility. And so I think the section is overloaded in the sense that, oh, we need to put this in, this in, this in, account for this. Let's hear the department on it. But there are other provisions as well, George, on the choice and control front.
Yes, let's talk about the other provisions.
So, look, I think someone reached out to me and they said, right, and this again is just a perspective, right? Like, we're all, like, the start thing is, when I read this, it seems like they're really focused on controlling how I act as a consumer in the scheme. I'm worried that they could slide back to line-by-line planning if they're not happy with how I use my funding. Because when you look at 32H, it talks about requirements, the ability when creating a statement of supports, a plan, it talks about particular supports specified in the plan will only be provided if specified requirements are complied with. And they may include a requirement that supports be provided by a specified person in a specified class.
That's so terrifying.
Right. Yeah, I mean, again, I was behind the curtain, I gave the bill initially to George, and I put 32H up on a Zoom to George, like literally 15 minutes after the bill came up. And, you know, we had this, like, you know, that's, it reads that way. Okay. Like, I mean, I'm just going to totally acknowledge the initial reaction, right? Now, crucially, here we arrive at our opening theme. This will be the subject, we are told, of detailed rules, these requirements. So I imagine, George, that at some point, if this bill did pass in this form, you would come to me and say, Darren, write me a set of restraints, or, you know, like we gotta put this genie back in the bottle and put some structure. Because at the moment, like some other provision, other bits of the bill, there's no structure. There's no, like, it's just, we have this power. We'll get to the details in the rules. As a lawyer, I said this in 2022, 2021. It's always better to say what the purpose of the power is, to talk about when you're going to use it. When you declare powers like this without any kind of structure or circumstances that, you know, any kind of flagging about when they're going to be used, it generates the reaction that you've just flagged, George. So for me, right, when I saw that provision, I said, okay, well, look, first of all, tell people what you're focused on if you have concerns that are going to be addressed by these requirements. Tell people that you value choice and control when you're announcing a power like this. And personally, I've always said it, whichever government it is, I much prefer us to not sort of take the approach of saying, here's a power, we'll get to the restraints later. I like us to say, here's a power, we're going to carefully design it based on what we're trying to achieve.
George, I would say that there's a few powers that go to, if those powers are used, they can impact on choice and control. And so you've talked about 32H, which is where there's requirements for how you get certain kinds of supports. There are other points in the bill where it talks about other kinds of elements of choice and control, like when you might not get your chosen form of plan management, or when that might be audited or taken away, and those sorts of things. Now, I think it's reasonable to say, yeah, as Darren says, those can look like quite scary powers, and one can probably imagine for most of those powers, there might be times where they're appropriate to use. But I also think it's quite reasonable to say it would be good to see some more constraints put on that in the bill, perhaps, or some more indication about how they're intended to be used. There's very little of that at the moment. There's a lot of let's leave it for the rules. And so that should be a part of this conversation about what's the intention behind these powers, and do there need to be things written into the bill about each of these powers that say, and the power can only be used in certain circumstances, or there are more constraints on how it's intended. And there are various ways to do that sort of thing. It's for the community to work out, well, where do these lines need to be drawn if we're really concerned about making sure that those sorts of powers aren't abused? What's the right approach? So it should start, I think, with some more talk, some more explanation from government, and it can then continue from there into, well, what needs to change? if anything, what needs to change about the bill?
So in summary, does this section of the bill, does the vibe of the bill take away or increase sourcing control for NDIS participants? I'll ask you first, Darren.
We need more protections in the bill. Happy to work on the design of those protections. And we've been here before, right? In terms of, if I was on this podcast before, where we talked about, you know, the importance of design and balance and, you know, structure and not rushing to create a big power. And I would just underline that for choice and control, it's such an important thing. And that's what people with disability are telling us, right? Because even when it came to assessments in the Every Australian Counts poll, it didn't, like, you know, there was a sort of divisive response or a division on the question of planning reform. But on choice and control, that is the vibe participants want to fill the scheme. And the great thing about choice and control and why we defend it is the empowerment that comes from it, the agency that comes from it. And having spent, you know, a decade in this area, the shift we always have to defend is in how people with disability are talked about and thought of by people like myself, right? And we have to, in this reform, start with that sense of, we don't want people being made to feel like a burden, like I don't have choices, all of the things that your life's work is about, George. So I would agree that there's work done here to really rally around what everyone accepts is a principle, to really make it sing in the reality of the scheme.
I agree that there's a need for more protections, ways to ensure that choice and control can't be overridden using some of the powers in this bill. I don't think that the bill automatically takes away choice and control, but I do think that the bill should reinforce that choice and control is to be protected and defended from any sort of incursions that are not appropriate. And I think that there's a need to make sure that those kinds of protections are put in.
Thanks, Fred. So I'll stick with you. You're involved a lot with NDIS appeals. Will the way in which people's funding amounts be calculated be something that will be reviewable under the proposal?
So there's a few things to say here. In the new proposed bill, in the world of the new framework plans that it proposes that we're talking about, with needs assessment leads to funding amount, leads to plan with that funding in it, when you get a plan, if you don't agree with the plan, you would still have the ability to say, I want to review that plan. However, it's not necessarily clear whether you could review the needs assessment underneath the plan. So there is a power in the bill that says in some circumstances, somebody can get a replacement assessment. If there's a bad needs assessment, you can say, well, maybe I'd like a replacement assessment for that, please. But that, when you can get a replacement assessment, who can order one, under what circumstances, is something that has been left for the rules to determine. Now, I'm quite uncomfortable with that, because if those rules aren't set up well, then what would happen is if you got a bad needs assessment and that needs assessment was used to calculate a funding amount that wasn't appropriate, you might appeal against the plan that results, but ultimately speaking, if you can't challenge the needs assessment or get a new one, then the problem would still remain. So I think I would really like to see more about, well, in what circumstances can you say, sorry, this needs assessment is wrong and I want to challenge it. I have the right, perhaps. I would like to see a version of the bill that established something like a right to challenge the needs assessment, to get a new one, to organise a replacement needs assessment. That's not currently something that the bill establishes. the government might have in its head that they intend to put that in the rules that come out down the track. They might not. Either way, I think it's essential that there is a way to engage with an inappropriate needs assessment. And that'll be something I'd be calling for one way or another.
That sounds like a very important amendment. I remember when you and I did a podcast last year, a strong message from you was that the NDIS often denied people the right to live on their own. And then when you appealed it, in most cases, the AAT found in the favour of the participant. With these changes, is it possible that people will actually just be stuck with living in group homes, and that the rights that we have now to live on our own will be taken away?
To the extent that the problem I've just illustrated there isn't fixed, if it was a case that a needs assessment came out and said, well, you just need to live in a shared home, and if there was no way to challenge that needs assessment, then yeah, the situation you're talking about with people winding up in inappropriate homes and no way to challenge them, that could be a result. So that's, I think, a really important reason why I would say, yeah, there needs to be a better way to engage with a poor needs assessment that might be done, as well as a really good reason to do, as Darren and I have each discussed, to make sure that those needs assessment tools and the method that's used after a needs assessment is done, make sure that both of those things, when they're put out in an instrument, that's been developed in the right way. There's nothing about the bill that innately means, there's no attempt here to say, change the emphasis on housing and living specifically. But as we say, if there's bad processes for making decisions, or if there's not appropriate ways to challenge them, then that's, of course, all kinds of bad decisions can result.
Darren?
Yeah, like on appeals, one of the things I wanted to raise was a dynamic I sometimes encounter. So you'll always be able to appeal the statement of support. Okay, now reasonable and necessary decision making is changing, and when the task of calculating a budget changes, the AAT's role will change to perform the same task. Okay, so the AAT must apply the minister's formula, and Mitchell has really hammered a point I really agree. So when I spoke about assessments earlier, I was being really balanced and presenting, you know, the optimistic picture. You know, I wasn't, you know, what Mitchell said there, you know, is a real area where we can all get a very quick commitment to really strong quality control on assessments, really strong oversight mechanisms. I think the fact they're not there underlines that there's a massive piece of work coming. Like, I mean, I do genuinely think that. But communication here is so important, George. Like, we're painting in the far corner of a massive disability reform canvas. And there's a lot of issues across the draft that I find myself saying, come on, let's bring this issue into this bill, because it'll make the difference in how people with disability feel, work through this. They need this information to understand where they stand. The other point I wanted to raise is, I think it's time for us to think about more targeted rights of appeal in this bill. So when a statement of support is approved, the budget is part of it. But there's also the requirements we talked about. There's also elements like what proportion is flexible and stated supports, which, you know, is another element, right? There are actually a multitude of decisions nested in the statement of participant supports. And I keep meeting people who are scared to appeal a single issue because they're worried all the things will get opened up. And if we are bringing in assessments, I think that danger sharpens a bit. Because one of the things that will arise is, if I've got an issue about plan management here, if I've got a specific issue about a particular aspect of the plan, I'm worried about having to talk about it all again.
So we need to have a conversation about how participants can have their concerns answered without being mired in really complex processes.
It sounds like there's a lot of things that we've covered today that need to be discussed, and that we need to make sure that the parliament hears from our community. How can our listeners have their say in it?
So many listeners will be aware that there's currently various forms of engagement happening through the Department of Social Services, but the big thing at this stage, I would say, is that the bill is currently before a Senate committee, and the Senate committee is examining it, is taking submissions from people, and will be considering, well, what amendments need to happen, how can the bill be refined, what communication can government be doing, the government be doing with the Senate and with the public. And so making submissions to that inquiry is a really good avenue. It's currently open until the 26th of April, which is not a lot of time. I guess listeners might also want to maybe air views about whether there should be other kinds of longer deadlines for some of those submissions or conversations to happen. Making submissions to the Senate at this point is probably, the Senate inquiry is probably the best way to be engaging the content of the bill and expressing anything that listeners think needs to be amended or tweaked.
And what happens next after this Senate inquiry ends? What's the next step, Darren?
So obviously then the bill would, they'll report back, and the bill would follow the normal process towards a vote. I think it's really important to end with by saying that this is my world, this world of law, reading bills. I want to say to people with disability that this is normal. So, you know, the bill, like, I'm great, like, I'm happy that we now have something to react to. And we've been given something that whatever you feel about the issues we've raised, no one can say that we're not all doing legwork on them. With this bill, we're all anchored now in criticizing it, disagreeing with it if you don't like it, saying that, you know, agreeing with it, supporting it if you like elements of it. But for me, understanding that me, people like me, a lawyer, the agency, the department, we don't own this process, right? Like, people and their voice are so important and historically have been the absolute core of getting the scheme, changing the scheme. So when we say put a submission into the Senate, it just has to be the gold dust, the knowledge all of you have, which is, this is my reality, and I'd like, by being heard, to set something in motion. I'd like to hear from you. Maybe I'd like a change. That's what the heart of this process is. And I have to say, it has always been a quality process when we have gone before the Senate. There have always been changes. We have never had anyone say to me, you know, you shouldn't be saying that. You know, we will go, we'll say the same things again. But more than anything, the real power is with people with disability. And I know it might feel like that when we're talking about technical things. But the reason we came on and talked about technical things was to clear them away so you can give us the critical energy that has always been the heart of the scheme.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you said that, because it is, the NDIS is here because people with disabilities, families and allies spoke up. And if there are things that you are concerned about, once again, we need to speak up. And I think that this conversation has been really helpful in helping people understand what they might want to speak up about. Mitchell, any final words?
Oh, look, I agree that there's a lot about the details of this bill that are pretty overwhelming. And so my final words are just that, PIAC, we've spent some time putting together a bit of an explainer. There are some things that we take a view on, other things we want to equip people to take a view on, and really help the community to say, well, how do I think about this rather than having to read through 50 pages of legislation and legal language. What do I think about something once it's been put to me in sort of more straightforward terms? So that explainer's on our website. There's a link in the show notes, and please, I encourage you to feel free to check it out.
Great, we'll put that in the description below. And we'll also put in the description the how to get involved and have your say. Mitchell, Darren, it's been very, very helpful and informative. You are two of the smartest lawyers I know. We'll get you on again when as things develop. How does that sound?
Look forward to it. Thanks, George.
Yeah, thanks a million, George.
That's all we have time for on today's episode of Reasonable and Necessary. As you know, we love your feedback, so please share your thoughts with us in the comment section below. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay well and reasonable.